On today's Bill of the Flatus Show, episode 116, Afghanistan, caramels, skunks, and broken windows. All of this and more. The Flatus Show, starring Kenty and Jose. Welcome to the Flatus Show. A low-calorie carbonated beverage for my diet. Delicious, kids. Welcome to the Flatus Show. Jose is out today with Johnny birding, because it is that time of year when all the shore birds, the winter birds, come down from the Antarctic to do whatever they do in the Cape Ann area. And Johnny just got a new camera today, because his old camera broke, so he's going to test it out. Welcome again. Today's show is, I talked about last week, but more coherently. I don't think I explained myself as well last week, because I was too distracted with all these different ideas and thoughts that were going through my mind. So I apologize. Though I don't have to apologize, because it's an audio blog. You live and you learn, right? I'm don't redoing it. I'm learning. I'm living. I'm showing you. I'm learning. Or whatever. And I have some ukulele songs today. And, you know, if you have a little Audrey segment, you know, be fun. So a couple things. I got some emails. I got an email from Kristen about the old man in Texas who shot his neighbor's thieves. And she's going to look into it to see if he broke local laws. You know, we'll see. I think she's a lawyer. So say thanks to Kristen for that segment. I'll read her email and we talk and discuss. So, you know, come and join the conversation over at the podcast. You can come to theflatusshow.com, click on the microphone, and we'll take you to the podcast, place where you can leave comments and read all sorts of stuff, so click links, come into the amazon.com store, help out a bitch, you know, and, you know, has all the information you need, how to email me and phone me. Yeah, all that stuff. And we'll do some other stuff, too. I'm working on some other changes. So lots of different things to click on and link to. Go take a look at it. It's pretty cool. And if you don't want all the other jazz on theflatusshow.com, you can just link to theflatusshow.blogspot.com, because that will be the podcast. But the web page itself has other pages, you know, other information. So there, Joe G. There's one page, but I don't know. What's up, Joe G? Listen, I got a call from Zillafag. And, I get calls from other people, too. But Zillafag called me because, you know, I tried to set you two up. Not on a date, okay? I'm not trying to, like, you know, pimp you out. I just figured, you know, you're in Columbus, Ohio, or you said you were in Columbus, Ohio. We don't really know where you're at, or even if you exist. And we'll hear that from Zillafag.com. Zillafag. We'll hear this from David from Zillafag right now.
Kenty, Joe G is scared of me, or something, or his emails are wrong. Well, he keeps on his website. He keeps putting the wrong emails or saying the wrong emails on his podcast, even though he'll never podcast again. But, so Joe G does not really live in Columbus or exist. He's not real. Okay, bye.
Well, thank you, Zillafag, for that phone call. Joe G is scared of you. Well, Joe G, if you're listening, you don't have to be afraid now. You know Zillafag. You've known Zillafag as long as I've known Zillafag. Well, at least you know his podcast as long. And as for Joji's podcasting, I mean, he works 60 hours a week at a university. I mean, that's a lot of hours. So, you know, but, you know, that would explain, you know, if Joji is not real, that would explain a lot as to why he wouldn't want to be my one of my internet boyfriends. Which, Zillafag, are you going to be one of my internet boyfriends? You have to send me a picture of yourself with a sign. You know, Alex of Sweden is my first internet boyfriend. He sent me a picture. He has a sign, so go look at the picture. If you go to the podcast, you'll see it. So, anyway. And, yeah. Laugh. Anyway. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, whatever. I sound like Mikey Pod. Okay, so we have Zillafag. Yeah. What do you think? I already responded, actually. So, let's go on. You're probably thinking to yourself, Kenty, you're on crack. But I really am not on crack because I don't do this, like, live, you know, one in one pass like some people. Because I do it mine the old-fashioned way, in segments. The next thing I want to play you is Hillary Clinton from a YouTube debate. I think it's from a YouTube debate. Anyway, it's Hillary Clinton on liberalism. Here we go.
It is a word that originally meant that you were for freedom, that you were for the freedom to achieve, that you were willing to stand against big power and on behalf of the individual. Unfortunately, in the last 30, 40 years, it has been turned up on its head, and it's been made to seem as though it is a word that describes big government, totally contrary to what its meaning was in the 19th and early 20th century. I prefer the word progressive, which has a real American meaning, going back to the progressive era at the beginning of the 20th century. I consider myself a modern progressive, someone who believes strongly in individual rights and freedoms, who believes that we are better as a society when we're working together, and when we find ways to help those who may not have all the advantages in life get the tools they need to lead a more productive life for themselves and their families. So I consider myself a proud, modern, American progressive, and I think that's the kind of philosophy and practice that we need to bring back to American politics.
It's nice to know that the Hillary campaign knows how to read Wikipedia. I'm sure she learned that and her at Swarthmore, wherever she went. Earlier this year, in Flatus Show 87, I talk about liberalism. This is what I say, and you can listen to it again if you go. I'll have the links for it.
You know, previously I talk about all sorts of things, religion and liberalism. And I've often, you know, actually I haven't talked about liberalism because I didn't know what it was. And I've mentioned it before. What is liberalism? Well, kids, I finally did some research. And you're probably going to be like, Kenty, we knew that all along. Well, why didn't you email me then? Okay, so liberalism, I think this is from Wikipedia. Wikipedia.org for all your information needs. Okay. Liberalism refers to a broad array of related doctrines, ideologies, philosophical views, and political traditions which advocate individual liberty.
So, that, there you go. And now, since this is a long show, on with the show.
She knows her proverbs, A to Z, and knows the good they bring.
But when she has to follow them,
well, that's another thing. Oh, little Audrey says, while the sun is out, make hay. Though she's not immense, there's a lot of sense in what little Audrey has to say.
The nurse was going to take little Audrey out for a walk. But the nurse was absent-minded, and she forgot until she was outside to take little Audrey with her. So she called up to the cook and said, "Cook, throw little Audrey out the window, and I'll catch her on the second bounce." The cook threw little Audrey out the window, and then she just laughed and laughed. She knew all the time that little Audrey was not a rubber ball.
Ah! Hi, this is Rebecca Nay from Tranny Rec Radio, and you're listening to The Flatus Show, starring Jose and his nasty dog, Kenty.
Mmm, what's cooking? That's right, now for the cooking portion of The Flatus
Show. This is okay, this is real because, you know, I'm not going to change it, but anyway. Now for the cooking portion of The Flatus Show. And now for the cooking portion of The Flatus Show. You can see what I go through. Okay, recently I sent out jellies to my some of my listeners. Longtime listeners, you know, we had a special deal going on. I sent them some jellies and stuff. So, two of my listeners, I sent, in addition to jelly, Dakota caramels I made. Now, what are Dakota caramels? That's what this is going to be about, the segment. Now, let me tell you, I got this from the Rumford Complete Cookbook from 1908. And they're delicious, and they're easy to make. And I will tell you how to make them. First, you'll need a fudge pan, which is, you can buy them in the supermarket. It's 9 1/4 inches by 6 1/2 inches by 1 inch. And they're, you know, those tin pans. This recipe makes one, you know, tin pan of caramels, which is, it makes a shitload of caramels because you cut them up into bite-sized pieces. And you can fill up these nice little boxes. It makes like 5 or 6 nice little boxes of candy. So, you know, just letting you know. So what you need, here it is. Okay, it's very simple. Dakota caramels. 2 cups of brown sugar, 1 cup of molasses, 4 ounces of chocolate. Now, I used, it just says chocolate, but I used Girardelli, 60% cocoa, bittersweet chocolate, baker's chocolate. It's also got baker's chocolate. So bittersweet chocolate is what I would use, and I would use at least 60% cocoa. But, you know, if you can get something better, that'd be good. If sometimes you can only buy bars that are 3 1/2 ounces, I think that'd be fine, too. I think you'd be good to go with 3 1/2 ounces. But, you know, 4 ounces of bittersweet chocolate. 1/3 cup of butter. 1 cup of milk. I also think you could use cream, but, you know, milk, whole milk would work for me. And 1 cup of shelled chopped nuts. I used walnuts. I think I may have used less than a cup of walnuts because I did it by hand. I mean, I did it by eye. I pulled out a bunch of walnuts, chopped them up. And I think I had a cup of whole walnuts, like, you know, out of the shell, like the halves. But when I chopped them up, there's less than a cup. So make sure you get a full cup of chopped nuts. I'd also include a teaspoon or two of vanilla extract. You can make your own vanilla extract, which I talked about before. So what you do is you put all of the ingredients into a pot except for the nuts. Okay, put it into a large saucepan, and you're going to cook it until it reaches 250 degrees on the candy thermometer, which I believe is, it will say, it will form a firm ball. Okay, the firm ball stage. And I believe that's 250 degrees on a candy thermometer. The recipe here says takes 20 minutes. I'm not sure if it took 20 minutes or not. I cooked it. Also, let you know, I cooked it over medium heat. I mean, I brought it to a boil at high heat and then turned it down. And it maybe took 15 minutes, 10-15 minutes, I don't know. But use a candy thermometer, it reaches 250 degrees. Remove it from the heat once it reaches that temperature. And, sit it down on a board because it'll be very hot. I mean, you know, like a cutting board, right? And then add your vanilla and your nuts. Watch your nuts now. Add your nuts and mix it together, and then just pour it into the greased fudge pan. You know, I greased it with butter. Pour it into there and just let it sit. Put it on a level area, you know, a level table, and just let it sit overnight. And then the next day, you can take it out and cut it into whatever size pieces you like. When I packed it away into a box, I covered them with confectioner sugar so they didn't stick together. So that is something else I would do. So that is the recipe for Dakota Caramels. You can find this recipe on my website at the podcast. And let me know what you think of that. One more time. Okay, last week I was talking about the Estates of the Realm, and I'm still fascinated by the idea behind it, and I went off a little bit off the path of talking about it. It really is, the Estates of the Realm are, it was broad divisions of society that distinguish three parts of society, the nobility, clergy, and commoners. And it was recognized in the Middle Ages and also later in Europe, okay? I find it really fascinating that... why I find it fascinating, let's start with that. Because, you know, when I was growing up, you know, in the 70s, and, you know, you had... Everybody was sort of equal, it seemed, you know? I mean, people... Some people made more money, some people made less money, but everybody... I always felt like I was part of a society, you know, I was part of a group, you know, and I thought all of America, I thought I was part of all of America. As I have grown older, I realized, especially in high school, that these groups, that there was no one group, there was no one America, this ideal that I had in my mind of what I thought life was like, or what equality was. I mean, because you meet people who are, I have met people who are richer, and how they treated you if you weren't part of their circle, and how you couldn't really get into their circle unless you had the money. You know, first of all, that's one thing. But you know, this is something that I don't know why we're taught as children in elementary school that we're apparently all equal and this is a classless society when it's clearly not. And you learn that. And the reality jibes with the, what's the right word? Propaganda. Now, I mean, ideally, this should be a society where we're all equals to succeed, right? And I think to a certain extent, equal in our power, you know, we're each equally have the same amount of power to affect change in our government and in society. But what happens is that there's the disproportionate distribution of wealth, I don't want you to think that I think government should be in the business of distributing wealth, because I don't think that works. But looking at the Estates of the Realm, and knowing what I know about history, because I read a lot of Roman history and stuff, maybe this is the way it is naturally, you know, at least for the last 2,000 years. You have 3% of the population who are wealthy and at the top, who are in control, and the other 97% are doing whatever, you know? I mean, the 97% are the bourgeoisie, the landowner, peasants. So that's like agricultural. And see, there is no more nobility anymore, okay? The nobility was replaced by industrialists, I would say. Because that's where the money is. It's like the bourgeoisie who became super wealthy. The bourgeoisie who became the industrialist became the new nobility. And of course you don't want to use nobility because that's, you know,
that smacks of royal, the royals and stuff like that. We don't want any kind of royalty here. And the clergy, which is interesting, you know that, you know, I'm sure this all has to do with, you know, the clergy. Where did the clergy come to? Where did they, from the Middle Ages, okay? Did they, you know, how, I want to know how, does anybody know about how the clergy, what their relationship to the nobility was? I mean, you know, you have history of the king, of kings being put in the place by the Pope, you know, who was controlling the government. So, like, what started the system? Was it the nobility which created this system, or the clergy? And I say that because the commoners wouldn't have created it because there's too many of them. It's probably one of the smaller units that, you know, smaller units of society which created the system, which put it in place. You know, a commoner wouldn't necessarily want that, I guess, you know. But it's, you know, it's interesting that the clergy was given the job, right? Their job was to take care of schools, hospitals, all these social things. When the nobility, they had justice, they were the judges, they did the taxation, they were the military, they were in charge of the military protection. The king, he was, I don't know what the king just sat there, he was divinely, the divine right of kings, right? I don't understand kings. But, I mean, maybe I don't understand kings because, you know, I have been indoctrinated with the American democracy, right? So I'm not saying that we should go to a kingship or anything. I think it's really fascinating. It's like, what does this mean? I mean, if this is the way it is, right, then do we want to change it or do we want to modify it? Or, you know, if this is the way the cards always fall, okay, this is the way it just naturally falls, how can we use this or understand this to make society better, you know, or can we make society better, right? What does that mean? What does it mean to make society better? You know, some would say, you know, morals, it's a moral thing to make society better. Well, government really can't make society better, right? But people can, you know. You know, it takes enough people to understand to do the change on their own, you know, change things on their own. I don't necessarily believe that changing laws to make changes in society is a good thing. I think government's job is not to make the laws. It's their job to initiate the conversation, and then people can make their decisions, you know. Then they make the decisions. And I guess that's making laws, but, you know, that's not right. That's not really what it should be. It should be, I don't know, maybe laws are the right thing, you know. Because, I mean, there are laws which, you know, everybody knows, obeys, you know. They don't have any problem with it. I guess that's the way it works. Maybe that's the way it works. So, I know I went off on some different angles and stuff, and sounded a little incoherent at times. At least I thought, because I listened to it a few times. But I'm really just fascinated with this, and I was thinking of all these different things about it and what it could mean. So, I hope you're just as fascinated with it as I am, you know. You should read into it because it's really, you know, I'm talking about the French, okay? But yeah, let's talk about the Fourth Estate. Okay, they have the three estates, right? I didn't even get to talk about the Fourth Estate. But I mean, let me just say something about the French Revolution. Okay, it says, among the direct causes of the French Revolution was a massive financial crisis caused by France's enormous debt. That sounds familiar? The lack of food and the outrageous prices, the government's lavish spending, and an archaic system of taxation, which brought little money to the national coffers by placing the greatest tax burden upon the Third Estate. In theory, all of the commoners. In practice, the bourgeoisie. While virtually ignoring the First Estate, the clergy, and the Second Estate, the nobility, successive attempts at reforming the system
had proven fruitless in the face of opposition from the First and Second Estates. So, the Fourth Estate, the term the Fourth Estate refers to the press. And when I was looking at the what blogging was, I mean, I think blogs too, you know, not just the traditional media. I guess that's what it means. The press means anybody who, any way that information can be transferred to people. I don't know. What do you think that means? Refers to the press. Anyway, that's what it referred to. Novelist Jeffrey Archer, in his book The Fourth Estate, made this observation. In May 1789, Louis the 16th summoned to Versailles a full meeting of the Estate General. The First Estate consisted of 300 clergy, the Second Estate 300 nobles, the Third Estate 600 commoners. Some years later, after the French Revolution, Edmund Burke, looking up at the press gallery of the House of Commons, said, "Yonder sits the Fourth Estate, and they are more important than them all."
There's a Hindu maid and a man. She swore by the stars up above her that he was the one to love her. But there came another one day, stole his Hindu maiden away. Hindu man is lonely and blue. In his dreams, he's calling to her. In Afghanistan, there's a caravan by the Pharaoh Oasis waiting for you, and for you only cross the desert sand. We will find a temple, there will be a bridal day for you, my idol, in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, there's a caravan by the Pharaoh Oasis waiting for you, and for you only cross the desert sand. We will find a temple, there will be a bridal day for you, my idol, in Afghanistan. All the wealth of Afghanistan cannot ease the heart of this man. Though the stars with splendor are shining, Hindu's heart can't stop its pining. Though he's trying hard to forget, he has hopes and dreams of her yet, thinking that she'll come back some day. To his idol he keeps praying. In Afghanistan, there's a caravan by the Pharaoh Oasis waiting for you, and for you only cross the desert sand. We will find a temple, there will be a bridal day for you, my idol, in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, there's a caravan by the Pharaoh Oasis waiting for you,
and for you only cross the desert sand. We will find a temple. There will be a bridal day for you, my idol, in Afghanistan.
I have a response. I got an email from Kristen Oblivion regarding the segment last week about what 12 gauge means. Remember, I asked everybody, I asked all my listeners, what does 12 gauge mean? Well, Kristen Oblivion was the only kind listener to respond with an answer. For all of my other listeners who don't know what it means. So, and she has some other interesting information in her email, which I'm going to read right now. She writes, "Hi, Kenty. I'm writing in response to your query with regard to shotgun gauges and their size and effectiveness. While I am certainly no expert with shotgun munitions, my grandfather had quite a selection of them in my growing up. I'll try best to describe my understanding of gauges in shotguns versus calibers in pistols and or rifles. Gauges for shotgun shells are similar in categorization as gauges of wire, not necessarily with actual size comparison, but with the scale model whereby lower means heavier. That is, a 20 gauge is smaller than a 12 gauge, which is smaller than an 8 gauge. 12 gauges are popular as a general purpose munition alongside several variations with regard to purpose. In summary, the lower the gauge, the greater the power and perceived recoil to the user. A 12 gauge shotgun is a very effective round for self-defense for its intimidating sound, size, and inarguable power. It's just as effective for game hunters in the field or for skeet shooting at the range. Gauges are not to be confused with caliber, which more or less measures the diameter of the actual projectile ejected from the cartridge. For instance, a .32 ACP is a smaller slug than a .380 automatic, which is smaller than a .45 ACP automatic Colt pistol. There is much debate and ambiguity surrounding the most effective round for handgun self-defense. Generally, the higher the caliber, the larger the round, thus perceived recoil to the user. But this is not an exact science, as a myriad of physical attributes also come into play as weight. Of the pistol, whether it is an automatic or a revolver, etc. Gun owners usually form personal preferences to their size, build, and need. I prefer the .380 round. In response to the incident of the shotgun defender, in his said protection of life and or property, I would have to research the current laws in place at the time of the shooting to judge whether or not a crime by the shooter had truly been committed within the scope of local and state law. In instances as this, it's easy to try to retrofit a law based on reaction or emotion. It's important, however, to try to negotiate and adjudicate based on law as it is written outside of commentary, remarks, and hearsay. My initial reaction is that it may raise a question of imminent danger to the gun owner with 911 police dispatch on the telephone with his cries for instant justice as if he were asking for some element of proverbial permission from the police department to shoot. Even as the alleged suspects had been reasonably subdued, it remains to be seen whether or not there was a committed crime by the civilian protector in his seemingly overzealous apprehension of a band of burglars. It is possible that a double crime may have been committed as the suspects had been incapacitated by threat. It is possible that a double crime may have been committed as the suspects had been incapacitated by threat alone. May have been. It is my guess that the civilian vigilante suffered from a unique cocktail of fear and anger, as do many soldiers and police officers in the field, whereby their actions and reactions are blurred in a passionate, confusing set of circumstance and audacity via the incident leading to the encounter and capture of those believed to be somehow responsible. In due consideration of these published reactions by both sides of this issue, I do find it interesting how quickly anti-gun personalities are quick to dismiss the severity of the criminal suspect's actions, and how quickly Second Amendment proponents rise to display their disproportionate roster of inarticulate racist buffoons. Surely, there are some reasonable gun owners out there who are better able to state their Jeffersonian-inspired positions, absent of the name, calling and... To state their Jeffersonian-inspired positions absent of the name, calling, and poorly formed expressions of anger run amok. It is in neither side's interest to trick ourselves into believing that maximum firepower solves every problem any more than should we deceive ourselves into a mindset that best wishes for an ideal world will silence all opposition to the contrary. Thank you, Kristen Oblivion of Dallas, Texas. Very interesting. I didn't know about that. So gauge refers to the shotgun shell, and caliber refers to the diameter of the projectile, i.e. bullet. And, so that's interesting, because all my Flatter Show listeners have no excuse to get that question wrong when they take their gun test to own guns for concealment, right? Especially the gay listeners, because, you know, there are a lot of crazy crackers out there who don't like gay people. So I think it would behoove us to carry guns to, put a cap in the ass of those who would cause us harm. Okay. Let's see here. I have, it's interesting. I agree. I mean, I see that. I mean, I only read two responses, okay, to that post. If you go to Topics, I think it is, or look it up. I mean, you'll find a blog, people blogging about this. I read two things off of the, one was the woman who said, oh, it's based on the race of the people, that's why he killed him. I mean, there's no indication of why the reason why he killed him is that he thought, I don't know why, because he's taken the law into his own hands, I don't know what the local laws are, so we shouldn't, rush to judge, I guess, right? I mean, however, and I'm not against anti-gun, but the gun owner, from what I've read, he was on the phone with the 911 inside his house, and he's like, they weren't getting there fast enough, so he was going to take care of business, I don't know. I don't know what to think of that. I mean, it's fine if somebody's trying to, is on your property or coming into your house, then you have the right to, shoot to defend yourself, shoot to kill. But, Randy said something interesting. He said the first thing he's going to do is make sure his family is safe. So if that means leaving out to the back, that's the first thing he's going to do. And even Kristen says that too. The use of a gun is, one part of your response, If you're in the corner, right, and they're coming after you, well, you know what? I'm going to shoot because I don't want them to hurt me, I mean, that's the thing. It gives you that option if you are trying to escape and you're caught in a corner. Well, you're not going to sit there like a rabbit in a trap while they kill you, right? No one should have to do that. So I recommend that all my listeners should, go to the state law where they live and make sure that their state law allows them to have concealed weapons. Okay? Because if everybody had a concealed weapon, no one would fuck with each other. Okay? What about crazy people? What about crazy people? Don't they have a right to defend themselves against their imaginary voices? Anyway. Yeah, so that's interesting. Thank you, Kristen, so much. You bring so much to the show with your pro-gun attitude. I still probably won't own a gun, but I appreciate it because I think it's an important issue to talk about and to see that not all gun people are, what'd she say, inarticulate racist buffoons. The 14 words of the Flatus Show, right? Let me get some grease in my finger. No, actually, not my finger. You know, whatever. Thank you, Kristen. Last week I talked about Chapter 40B and really didn't say much about what Chapter 40B was. Now, there is a website called repeal40b.com, and this is basically for Massachusetts residents, though I'm sure each state has its own 40B of some sort. I'll tell you what Chapter 40B is. Passed in 1969, Chapter 40B, the Comprehensive Permit Law, is a Massachusetts statute that allows developers to be exempt from local zoning guidelines and to appeal any local zoning board denials or restrictions to the State Housing Appeals Committee, also known as HAC. The HAC is a housing court created by this statute to hear cases. Court in parentheses. All of this is permitted if developers include a certain percentage of affordable housing, also in quote, 25% for owner-occupied and 20% for rentals. 40B defines affordable housing as something that can be afforded by household making 70 to 80% of the local median income, having been subsidized by certain state or federal housing subsidies programs and have long-term deed restrictions. I found that really remarkable that affordable housing are for households making 70 to 80% of what the median income is, okay? In some places on Cape Ann, the median income, right? There are very rich people who live on Cape Ann, okay? They skew what the median income is, okay? So you might have a bunch of people making, you know, $80,000 a year, okay, household, right? And then you have a couple people living in your neighborhood who are billionaires or millionaires, you know? And it's accurate, right? So when you come to figure out what the median income is, I mean, that makes it, you know, a lot higher than what it actually is, okay? I think that, see, that's, and they also, this affordable housing is based on income and not wealth, you know? That's what it should be based on. It should be based on your wealth. Now, you're probably saying, Kenty, what the hell are you talking about? Well, maybe I'll talk about this next week about the wealth. But I could actually pause and I'll print out what I learned about wealth today. Okay, wealth, as opposed to income, is the difference between your assets and your liabilities. So, you could have somebody who is very rich, who makes a lot of income, right? But they have a lot of liabilities, which makes their wealth, you know, zero or whatever. So that is that's what this definition of wealth is, according to Wikipedia. So if you go to Wikipedia, look for distribution of wealth, you'll see the article. And I think it's interesting because a lot of these government, like from the 60s, like when the Great Society was being made by the Lyndon Lyndon administration. It's all based on income and not wealth. So I think that is really interesting. Because I have seen, okay, talk about welfare people, okay? People on welfare, that's all based on income, right? I knew people on welfare who had Rolls Royces. They had every amenity, modern amenity that you could think of. My father and mother, I mean, there were problems with their marriage and my father's finance, the way he ran his business, okay? We didn't make a lot of money. I mean, and to be frank, I mean, you know, he gambled away his money and he drank his money and he whatever. I don't know what he did with his money, but we didn't really see it after a certain time because, I mean, we lost our house and everything. But when we went to go try to get food stamps, they told us we made too much money. And my father had no, wasn't making any money. He was self-employed. He had broken his leg. He couldn't work. And we made too much money. I remember that. And the people at the welfare office looked at us like, why are you here? You don't deserve to have welfare. I'm serious. So we didn't get food stamps. I don't know. And that's when we starved. It was the winter of starvation. I think I talked about that before. But anyway, yeah, so... Yeah, well, my tea is ready. Hold on, I'm going to pause again. Okay, before I get too much off of the topic, that is basically what Chapter 40B is. There's a repeal 40B, and here are the problems with 40B. Developers have successfully used 40B to build over 700 developments across the state that violate local zoning rules for density, conservation restrictions, and type of housing. 40B limits the definition of affordable so much that most people in need are not helped by it. The housing court created by 40B is not impartial and is mandated to support more development, thus giving communities almost no fair chance for appeal even when developers act unreasonably. 40B developers bait and switch by saying one thing to get the permit and then doing differently. Once the land is 40B permitted, developers can do almost anything they want. For instance, changing the plan from rentals to owner-occupied, thus boosting their profits. Because it helps to override local control over unit density, 40B allows developers to overbid on parcels, effectively driving up the price of land and thus making all housing more expensive. Cocksuckers. In the decades since 40B projects have been destroying open space and local control over communities, housing affordability has grown worse, driving Massachusetts to the very bottom, 49th in the country. Summary of our petition in lay terms. Our proposal would repeal sections 20 to 23 of MGL Chapter 40B. We are doing this to 1. Improve local control over communities so that the state cannot force a city town to do what is not in its best interest. 2. Eliminate the unfair housing court so that communities have a fair and impartial appeal and review process. And 3. Expand the definition of affordable housing to include a bigger range of people. 40B only targets 70 to 80% of median income, meaning that low-income people aren't helped, and two-income families such as teachers, police, firefighters aren't helped either. Oh, that's interesting. It should be a single income. That makes it even worse. Please help us make progress today by signing our petition to put this question on the ballot. You can find them at repeal40b.com. You can write to them at Repeal 40B Ballot Question Committee, P.O. Box 424, Chelmsford, Massachusetts, 01824. That being said about 40B, I wanted to talk about mortgages and something interesting I found out. Because, you know, with this recent debacle with... these, you know, people who are losing their houses because they were given these mortgages that they really shouldn't have been given in the first place, okay? There's a problem with the people who lend money for real estate. And one thing it one thing we have seen is that they're lending money that they're sort of like caving in to the idea that the value of a house. Okay, there was this bubble, okay? And I'm not really sure what a bubble means, but that's what they're calling this housing bubble. Houses, okay, the value of a house in Massachusetts, right, was in, okay, what's a good example? The value of houses have changed dramatically over the last 10 years, okay? That's one thing. I mean, in some cases, tripled. I mean, all over the place, okay? The problem is that it was unrealistic to begin with, okay? And the people who lend money for people to buy these mortgages sort of gave the full amount, right? I mean, now, okay, when you buy a mortgage, you buy points. Okay, you have so much money you're putting into the house, right? But in my view, banks or whatever, right? People, I shouldn't say banks, but not just banks, but the lending industry really should look at. John, I have tea here. If you want some?
Do you know the date?
Today's date?
Yeah.
The 25th. Okay, in hindsight, I'm thinking that the lending industry really should have looked at the value of the house and said, well, yeah, I know that Joe Schmo in Watertown is asking for $500,000 for the house. However, historically, we can see that this house really is only worth $200,000. No one in their right mind is going to pay $500,000 for this piece of squalid land in an overly populated area. I don't care if you're a I don't care if you're a new technologist living in outside the 495 belt or not, you know? So my question is that, yeah, sure, we'll lend you the money to buy this house, but we're only going to lend you up to $200,000, you know? You have to, in that case, they should, the lending industry should put a check on this stuff about as to what the value is. They're not really putting a check on the value. They're putting a check on what they're willing to lend, okay? I mean, yes, if somebody really wants to spend $500,000, then you know what? You're going to have to fork over $250,000. We'll lend you $250,000 because that's all it's really worth. If you want to put $500,000, that's fine. Now, you might be saying, well, they're making a value judgment. You know, they're going to change the economy. No, they're not. They're being smart because they should look at these things historically. I mean, if people want to spend, you know, X amount of dollars on housing, let them out of their own pocket. But when people are being lent this money, and then eventually you find, you know, these poor people being lent money, I shouldn't say poor people, but whatever, because apparently these loans are coming, you know, they're changing. I guess they were some sort of loan where they started off at a low interest rate for a couple years, and then it went to prime plus whatever. And when it went to prime plus forever, they can't afford that because, you know, they thought 3% was the rate, okay? The problem, and you know, that's one thing, right? That's one problem. But the people who are buying these houses probably paid too much for their house. They probably agreed to pay too much for the house. And the banking industry sort of just said, the lending industry, I should say, just said, okay, we'll lend it. Because it's not just banking, because banking is different, okay? The lending part of banking. Because they're just lenders, okay? That's really what the problem was. It was not banks necessarily. Because they're, you know, they have other ways they do things. But lending, okay? The mortgage lenders. So they're responsible in a way for letting this, you know, get out of hand. You know, the cost of everything, the price of these houses, and letting crap hit the fan. You know, and it really hurts everybody in the long run because, you know, the emperor's new clothes, people are going to see that he's naked. Now, at the same time, I benefited from, John and I benefited from these new loan programs, though we didn't we had a, I told John, you know, when we're getting the place, when we were looking for our place, we didn't really have a lot of money to put down. So we did have less than, you know, the point or two or whatever. We had some money. And because of these, the loan, the way these loans were being made, we, you know, we could put some money in. We couldn't put down a lot of money. Now, at the same time, I think I bought a fair price for where we were. I was pretty conservative and vigilant in finding a place that we could afford and not try to buy something that we couldn't afford. Because I'll tell you, the guy who was trying to sell us places, oh, yeah, you know, the difference between, you know, the difference of $60,000 really isn't that much in the mortgage. You can get these low, you know, interest loans. I'm like, Sharita, I know about banking, and I know how these loans work. I want a fixed rate and a fixed loan, and I have a fixed loan on this amount. This is what I figured out. I don't want to be house poor. I have to have money for mortgage. I have to have money for maintenance. I have to have money for heating. This is what we can afford. And so it was difficult, but we finally found the place. Okay? Which brings me to this point, okay? And so I'm grateful for some programs because it allowed John and I to have be homeowners, okay? And that was good. I think that was a good thing because it was responsible. You know, it actually looked at our actual income. When they put the loans through, you know, we put down our income, but they didn't inflate our income or do any of that kind of crap. So I thought it was, you know, fair. Because I worked hard for my, you know, for what I do, you know. Anyway, I mean, to buy or whatever. This is getting long, so I don't want to hurry up. Where was I? Oh, yeah, about mortgages. Something interesting I found the other day is I was looking at online at old the way mortgages worked in the past, the 40s and the 50s. Today, you know, you have a mortgage and you pay the mortgage. You know, of course, you have money. The bank lends you money and they'll take care of the escrow tax, right? Your real estate tax, I mean, goes in escrow, right? You pay extra for that. Fine, right? That's good. Something else I saw in a program was you could sign up where you could pay X dollars amount for heating and maintenance, housing the maintenance on your house and heating and stuff. So you know people who were lending back then realized that yeah they're buying a house but they have to maintain it, so they that should be part of their. Their monthly payment, you know. I guess it worked somehow that they figured out what, you know, the oil cost for a year and what maintenance generally cost for a year. And then they would pay, you'd pay into it, right? And if for some reason something happened, you would have to pay extra money into it, you know, until it was paid off. But I thought that was really interesting and it'd be really good product for today because that way, people who are lending money for houses, right? I mean, but the thing is, nowadays everything is like, you know, you sell your mortgages and stuff like that. The banks don't keep. I mean, people who lend money for houses, they don't keep the loans on their books generally. You know, they're sold to wherever. But you know, the thing is, with the community, to keep the money in the community is that you lend the money, do it responsibly, just not try to get rich overnight. You know, have this kind of program where, yes, you're going to pay, the lender should say, yes, this is the value of the house. This is what they're trying to sell you. But do you know it's going to cost you this much money to maintain it? And what about not just today, but tomorrow? You know? And I don't know. You know, I'm getting beyond myself right here, and I also know about people, home inspectors, who aren't necessarily, like, the most, you know, reputable. So that's another thing, home inspectors. I don't know. The system needs to be changed, and it needs to be changed to something that is beneficial for us all. Thank you.
gray shadows creep, and the world is asleep. In the still of the night, baby creeps down a flight. First she looks all around without making a sound. Then baby toddles up to the telephone and whispers in a baby tone, "Hello, Central, give me no man's land. My daddy's there, my mama told me." She tiptoed off to bed after my prayers were said. "Don't ring when you get my number, or you'll disturb Mama's slumber. I'm afraid to stand here at the phone, 'cause I'm alone. So won't you hurry? I want to know why Mama starts to weep when I say now I lay me down to sleep. Hello, Central, give me no man's land." Through the curtains of night comes a beautiful light, and the sunshine that beams finds a baby in dreams. Mama looks in to see where her darling can be. She finds her baby still in her slumber deep, a whispering while she's fast asleep. "Hello, Central, give me no man's land. My daddy's there, my mama told me." She tiptoed off to bed after my prayers were said. "Don't ring when you get my number, or you'll disturb Mama's slumber. I'm afraid to stand here at the phone, 'cause I'm alone. So won't you hurry? I want to know why Mama starts to weep when I say now I lay me down to sleep. Hello, Central, give me no man's land."
Are you tired of being alone? Not anymore. You can be Kenty's internet boyfriend. Just send Kenty an email or a voicemail declaring such, and a picture, and Kenty will proudly display his bevy of boyfriends in his special photo album. Now you can tell people you have a boyfriend. An internet boyfriend. There is no obligation to have sex with Kenty, go on dates, remember birthdays or anniversaries. It's that easy. Be Kenty's internet boyfriend today. And now, girls can join as well. Void where prohibited by law. Only on The Flatus Show.
Just what love will do. Love may live a day or all life through.
Another 5-minute mystery. Thank you.
Police headquarters, Inspector Harris speaking.
Inspector Harris, this is Peter Arnold.
Yeah, what can I do for you?
Inspector Harris, I think I'm going to be murdered.
What?
Just a minute ago, I received an anonymous letter threatening my life.
Have you any idea who it's from?
No.
Where are you now?
I'm at my office in the Acme building, 10th floor.
I'll be right over. Stay right where you are.
Oh, yes, Inspector. Only hurry.
Here's the place, Chief. The Acme building.
Okay.
Hope we're not too late.
Well, if we hurry, we can...
What's the matter, Chief?
Yeah. On the street, little pieces of glass.
Glass? Where'd that come from?
I don't know.
Hey, Chief. Look up there. See that broken window?
That's Arnold's office. Come on, Stacy. Something's wrong up there. What's happened up here?
Who are you?
We're the police. I'm Inspector Harris, and this is my assistant, Joe Stacy.
Oh, am I glad you've come. I'm Lois Cranston, Mr. Arnold's secretary.
Yeah?
Something terrible's happened. Mr. Arnold locked himself in this office.
Yes?
And just a minute ago, I heard a shot and then glass breaking.
Come on, Stacy. Help me break down this door.
Okay.
All right. Ready? One, two, three. There.
Holy Moses. Look, Chief.
Is anything wrong? And... Mr. Arnold!
Will you look at that? A bullet hole right through his head.
And the window's broken. The murderer must have been standing on the roof of that building across the alleyway and fired through this window.
I'm afraid you're wrong.
What do you mean?
I mean that I'm arresting you, Miss Cranston, for the murder of Peter Arnold.
How does the inspector know that Miss Cranston murdered Peter Arnold? We'll give you the solution in just a moment, but first... Story.
Mr. Arnold was shot from outside. The broken glass proves it.
Oh, that's what you've tried to make us believe. No, Miss Cranston. You shot Peter Arnold from this very room, broke the window to make it look like the shooting was done from outside, and then went out and locked the door. It would have been a perfect murder except for one thing.
What was that?
The broken window. You see, we found the fragments of glass on the street.
Well?
If the bullet had been fired from the outside, the fragments of glass would have gone in the direction of fire. In other words, the glass would have landed inside the room, not on the street. No, Miss Cranston, you murdered Peter Arnold. I don't know why you did it, but we'll soon get the story out of you at headquarters.
Waking in the Blue by Robert Lowell from his collection of poems, Life Studies. This, by the way, is not Creative Commons. So, listen, Sharita, I'm just reading it, so listen. The night attendant, a BU sophomore, rouses from the mare's nest of his drowsy head, propped on the meaning of meaning. He catwalks down our corridor. Azure day makes my agonized blue window bleaker. Crows maunder on the petrified fairway. absence. My heart grows tense as though a harpoon were sparring for the kill. This is the house for the mentally ill. What use is my sense of humor? I grin at Stanley, now sunk in his 60s, once a Harvard All-American fullback, if such were possible, still hoarding the build of a boy in his 20s as he soaks a ramrod with the muscle of a seal in his long tub, vaguely urinous from the Victorian plumbing. A kingly granite profile in a crimson golf cap, worn all day, all night, he thinks only of his figure, of slimming on sherbet and ginger ale, more cut off from words than a seal. This is the way day breaks at Bowditch Hall at McLean's. The hooded night lights bring out Bobby, porcelain 29, a replica of Louis the 16th, without the wig. Redolent and roly-poly as a sperm whale as he swashbuckles about in his birthday suit and horses at chairs. These victorious figures of bravado, ossified young. In between the limits of day, hours and hours go by under the crew haircuts and slightly too little nonsensical bachelor twinkle of the Roman Catholic attendants. There are no Mayflower screwballs in the Catholic Church. After a hearty New England breakfast, I weigh 200 pounds this morning. Cock of the walk, I strut in my turtle-necked French sailor's jersey before the metal shaving mirrors and see the shaky future grow familiar in the pinched indigenous faces of these thoroughbred mental cases, twice my age and half my weight. We are all old-timers. Each of us holds a locked razor. You've been listening to The Flatus Show. You can reach me at flatusshow@gmail.com or come by and visit my website at theflatusshow.com. Thank you for listening.
I don't know why you did it, but we'll soon get the story out of you at headquarters.